I'll be speaking on high energy radiation from GRBs. This is the 2006 version of the talk. I want to mention my associates, Armin Atoyan and Marcus Bircha. But given the real excitement from SWIFT. Okay. Okay, the marquee title of the talk is SWIFT Impact, and I'll focus on that. And this is a sort of a exercise in how people can look at the same data set and come to different conclusions. Let me start out by saying I'm on the same wavelength as most theorists. I think the external shock model and blast wave physics gives unbelievably good description of the afterglow observations. And I think it even gives a good description of some of the prompt observations. And to show you how few parameters there really are in this model, we know you require large amounts of energy, 10 to the 52 ergs. And if you take this ratio, the blast wave physics is very insensitive to this ratio, something to the 3/2 power. That's a sort of generic and fine in afterglow models. Gamma not 300, that might seem to be a fine tuning, but if you assume that there are sources in nature that rarely make high Lorentz factor outflows, then, and once you go to low Lorentz factor outflows, we know that the emission is very weak. So actually, there's a selection bias actually to get gamma naught equal to 300. I assume that the blast wave starts as a very thin shell for reasons that may become apparent. This epsilon E parameter, 1/3, well, this means that lots of energy has been deposited in the electrons. Epsilon B, greater than 10 to the minus 4th, so you require some mechanism for magnetic field generation. P of 2.3 shock spectral index, if that's true, who knows. The maximum electron energy, it's not sensitive to that, given a falling electron spectrum. And theta jet, 0.1 observations. So these are very, it's a set of parameters that actually, to my mind, fits the afterglow fairly well with wiggles, and the prompt phases by introducing clumps in the external medium. So, and this is just a representative set of parameters. And so this is the point I want to make to you, that I think you can explain X-ray flares and prompt gamma ray pulses from inhomogeneities in the external medium. But one of the puzzles that the SWIFT observations has presented are these rapidly falling light curves. And these appear, as you see, at a few hundred seconds if you go to the source frame, typically 100 seconds. The temporal decay index is -3. You see these often. You just go through a sequence of observations. You see these decays. Sometimes it's more like canonical expectations from the blast wave physics, predictions that were made. But remarkably frequently, maybe 60 to 80% of the time, there are these rapid decays. And what you should also notice here is that there's no rise. It actually flattens. These are the extrapolations of the band into the X-ray telescope band. So this is something that demands to be understood from the SWIFT observations. This is another sequence of observations. You see that. The X-ray flares, we need to understand where they come from, why they're so rapid and luminous at the late times. And also structure in the light curve. But it all comes down to kind of a homework exercise that the SWIFT people have presented to us, represented in this figure by Zhang et al, that you have a sort of flat component here, typically -3. Then there's this plateau phase, then the canonical afterglow phase, and then a jet break phase. And this is how I look at it. I use different notation. I like alpha being kind of old school in that, so we have a nu f nu index A and a decay index chi. And what we find is that the behavior that the SWIFT observations reveal is very well behaved by a curvature or so-called high latitude effect in most cases. Now, when you're on this portion of the side, it doesn't really matter that these violate this curvature relation. So I'll describe that. Suddenly, if you have a spherical shell of emission, and then you suddenly turn it off, then you start just receiving the high latitude emission. And if you assume that there was initially the same emissions from all portions of that spherical shell, then you get a very clear behavior between the decay of the emission and the spectral index of the emission. And that's what this is, it shows right here. And it doesn't matter on this side if they violate it, because there could be just some radiation physics going on. But on this side, it's very puzzling how you could have extremely rapid decays that don't follow this behavior. So this was the puzzle, is to try to understand the most extreme cases. So this is, and also just to understand why these show the curvature effect in so many cases. And essentially it comes down, how do you turn this emission off very quickly so that the curvature process can actually apply? So you really have to turn this emission off to get a curvature type effect. Well, canonically, colliding shells do that. One shell hits another, it's got this nice spherical symmetry, it radiates, then they adiabatically expand, there's a decay, and that gives you a curvature effect. And as a corollary of this curvature effect, if the nu f nu peak flux goes as the energy of that nu f nu peak flux cubed. And this was my proposal to look for this in Swift data, but we know that we won't see this, we don't see the E peaks so well in Swift, but GLASS, GBM, and LAT are coming right up in a year and a half. Combined with Swift, it will be possible to undertake this study. But okay, so this is the explanation of the curvature effect in colliding shells. So a couple years ago, I did a study on decaying spectral flashes that was appropriate to a colliding shell model. And essentially, I didn't want to be bogged down by details of models. I wanted to do it purely kinematically. So I took a relativistic sphere with a certain width. I illuminated it for a certain co-moving time. I turned that emission off. And you get, and this is a kinematic, this would undergird any model study, that you're limited by these kinematic effects, which is just like travel time. And you get, you can change the width of the emission region. You can change the duration of the emission region. And then you can change how far out this location is. But you always get rising curves with a longer decay time scale. So this is what I call a thin shell pulse, where it's very thin, but the duration is long. This is where the long duration is long, and it's no longer thin, so you get characteristic curves like this. And but the very shortest curves are these curvature pulses, essentially instantaneously illuminated and then decaying away. And again, you get a slow decay phase. Now, let me just remind you what the Swift observations show. They never show, and I can't find a single case, where you see a pulse. And you can go through the whole data set, and I never see anything that has a rising phase that is on the same time scale or less as implied by these kinematic studies as the decaying phase. I interpret this to mean, although colliding shells could explain X-ray flares, I can't possibly see how they explain the Swift observations of X-ray decays, and I place that as a challenge to people in the colliding shell camp. So how do I explain it with external shocks? Well, you have to turn off. So here you have the gamma ray jet going out, sweeping up material. It could be a clumpy medium to make pulses. But then what happens is you have to turn off this emission to get the curvature effect. One way to turn off the emission is to go to a new location where the density changes, right? It goes to low density, the epsilon B parameter stays the same, so the magnetic field decays, or somehow you just cause an epsilon B jump. And in order to get the time scale, given a gamma naught of about 300, then you need this density jump to take place between 10 to the 16th and 10 to the 17th centimeters. But another feature, and this will give you the curvature effect when it passes through, but to actually make it go faster than the curvature effect, you have to make a highly jetted flow. So actually you get a beaming break from the gamma ray emission, and combined, we can explain this. So I used Jim Chang's code, described in 1998, which has full treatment of blast wave physics, forward shock physics, only the forward shock though, special relativity, light travel time, dynamical evolution of blast wave, doesn't have to be an adiabatic blast wave, synchrotron SSC, adiabatic losses on electrons, which are injected as a power law using the standard blast wave formalism. And indeed, if you have a narrow jet, such that it goes through a gamma beaming break, as well as this density jump. Now, I won't go through all these panels, but this shows the evolution of the blast wave, the evolution of the electron spectrum, the evolution of the SEDs. But here are the light curves, and the light curves can go through very abrupt breaks at 100 seconds. So I pose that as a solution to this conundrum. And this is the blast wave geometry that I find in accord with Swift's observations. It doesn't always have to be this way, but in those most extreme cases where you have these rapid decays, you have a gamma jet which is smaller than the bulk of the relativistic outflow. So this might be gamma naught of 300, and this might be gamma naught of 50. And this is sort of 1 degree-ish, and this only is maybe in 10% of the time, not all the time, probably most of the time, the gamma naught is 300 throughout the canonical jet. And this assumes that the directional energy release is constant within this entire jet. And so it's a structured jet solution, as well as the structured density medium solution to the Swift observation. There's a low B where this epsilon B parameter is 10 to the minus 4th. Note that there's a strong self-Compton component here, and you get these extraordinary rapid decays. Okay, let's go now to the X-ray flares. How do you make the X-ray flares? Well, canonically, you have the explosion. You have a narrow blast wave pounding into a cloud. And there's lots of claims that you can't get a narrow structure, but even as far back as 99, we showed that you can get short timescale variability with good efficiency as long as your clouds are quite small. But the clouds have to have a thick column, and you have to have a dominant forward shock. So there's some physics issues here that aren't resolved. Now, this is a complicated slide, which I won't go through, but it proves that you have to have a, once you go past the spreading radius, you normally get a spreading due to internal motions in the blast wave shell. One has to assume for this interpretation, and this is a requirement on the model, that it doesn't spread very much, this blast wave. So I need a thin shell. So now we've looked at the physics of this, or I should say I have, because I wanted to also check on what we get from the internal shell camp to see how good they do their physics. So here's the canonical model. There's a cloud, which this applies equally to a relativistic shell. You have a blast wave coming out and hitting it. And I put the cloud in a spherical cap geometry with constant locations. I've done this analysis, which is now more or less complete. It wasn't complete when I reported at Swift. But it does do the full forward shock, reverse shock physics. So here's a collision phase, forward shock going forward, reverse shock, it's going through the cloud, accelerating it, decelerating the shell material. Depending on which one passes through, the reverse shock passing through the shell before the forward shock crosses the cloud, you get new injection. I do a fully detailed treatment, and Jonathan will recognize this equation of the light travel time effects. I use the canonical formalism, except where it doesn't apply. And there's an expansion phase where it passes out. As you see, well, I was more interested in, during this study, to get these gamma ray burst pulses. When eta equals 1, you have a forward shock Lorentz factor of around 60, and then you have a decaying Lorentz factor of the emission. And the problem there with eta equals 1 is gamma is too small, so the emission is too dim. So you really need large values of or very thin shells. And this shows a calculation. And giving all these phases of the emission for the interaction of this very simple system, something I've not seen yet done in an internal shock. And look, you get a very nice gamma ray burst type spectrum. It peaks around, well, here it's 100 keV, maybe 10 keV. This is nu F nu spectrum, epsilon B 10 to the minus 4th. Here it's right at an MeV, it peaks. This has a nice reverse shock component, so you can certainly get reverse shock emission. This shows all these different phase components as the blast wave shell interaction takes place. But it looks just like, and this is calculated at the peak of the flare, of this elementary flare. And this is what happened. Okay, so what does the light curve look like for a flaring event? It looks like this curvature pulse. It rises quickly, and then it decays away. And this shows what pulses from this blast wave cloud interaction look for clouds on axis. As you get off axis, they become very dim, but on axis, they're very short. So, okay. To conclude, I find the challenge and the solution to the Swift observations of rapid decays in X-ray flares due to a transition in medium properties at 10 to the 16th to 10 to the 17th, and a narrow high gamma naught jet in cases of steepest light curves, pulses, and an external shock model. So where does this transition feature come from at 10 to the 16th to 10 to the 17th centimeters? Well, in a gamma ray burst outflow, you unavoidably have neutrons coupled in the flow. And those neutrons can decouple. Sometimes they decouple due to lack of the coupling between proton-neutron collisions. Sometimes they stay in the flow, and then as the proton component decelerates, the neutrons go ahead of it, and then they precondition the medium. And all of this activity ends around 10 to the, few times 10 to the 16 centimeters. So that might be part of the solution. Okay, neutrons going out. Well, this segues into, if they're neutrons that are thermal, we've talked about the non-thermal lepton processes. What about non-thermal proton processes? You unavoidably get very high energy protons in gamma ray bursts if you're accelerating a non-thermal proton population. And they can also produce high energy radiation signatures through photomeson production. But one nice feature about, what I think is a nice feature about the possibility that gamma ray bursts accelerate cosmic rays, is then you can understand the full cosmic ray spectrum above the knee. I accept with Felix that below the knee it's probably due to supernova remnants in general that are accelerating cosmic rays. Above the knee, of course, we know that gamma ray bursts are very similar to supernovae. These are the ones that collapse to black holes rather than collapsing to neutron stars. And when they accelerate, and they have relativistic outflows that are efficient to accelerating particles to 10 to the 20th EV. So if you assume that they follow a star formation rate history, you get extragalactic cosmic rays from GRBs outside of our galaxy, and also within our galaxy, assuming that there are gamma ray bursts within our galaxy, which I know is a bit of a contentious right now. But if that's the case, these neutron high-energy cosmic ray outflows, there's going to be associated radiation signatures. This shows a proton synchrotron radiation signature at the high energy. But I favor also signatures associated with photomeson production. So this is where calculations of Atoyan, where we inject non-thermal power laws of neutron protons, which then lose energy through photohadronic processes, making escaping neutron distributions. And there's this issue of, to get efficient photomeson production, you need a large radiation density of the synchrotron emission, which also causes strong gamma-gamma absorption. So there's this inverse relation that Peter and his colleagues have pointed out between the probability of seeing neutrinos, high-energy neutrinos, and the prospect of seeing high-energy gamma rays just due to that feature. But for the leptonic portions of the emission, we certainly expect, this has gamma-gamma opacity included, we expect to see TEV radiation. It's in the colliding shells that you get much stronger gamma-gamma opacity effects. So if GEV, even to TEV, turns out to be confirmed in highly pulsed events, it puts a constraint on the Doppler factor and all these features. So we've predicted the neutrino production, and IceCube is scaling up by the end of this decade. They should be able to detect this if gamma ray bursts are the sources of cosmic rays. Armin has calculated these cascade, very complicated cascade calculations, which should show up in gamma ray burst spectra, and maybe they already have shown up in gamma ray burst spectra. This shows Magda Gonzalez's paper, where we see this anomalous emission component in the BASCII task that Armin and I interpreted as due to this neutron production and outflow making what we call hyper-relativistic electrons, electrons at higher energies than you can accelerate through Fermi processes because they're secondaries of protons, and they have very unusual synchrotron spectra, which nicely reproduces that. This goes back to old issues about clean and dirty fireballs, but the point being that you can get strong self-Compton components, which when they decay away, the self-Compton component sweeps through the GEV range, producing long-lived emission. Perhaps it's just the self-Compton component passing through that's producing this long-lived emission. So this shows light curves with and without beaming at MEV energies. And I keep looking for the SSC bump in X-ray telescope light curves, and SWIFT people should be on notice to look for that too. I just don't see it. What does it all mean in the last 1 minute? This, I'm very impressed by the fact that this proxy of nickel 56 seems to have the same distribution for 1BCs as well as GRBs. And I interpret that to mean whatever makes it in 1BCs is making it in supernovae. So that means it's a core collapse to a neutron star. And, well, I won't go, maybe this is, I don't have time to state all the arguments I have against long-duration GRBs. But if that's the case, then you have a core collapse making the nickel 56, just like in 1BCs. You're left with a neutron star, but to make the gamma ray burst, ultimately, it's the type that collapses to a black hole. You have an episode of strong pulsar activity, an Ousov phase, let's say, which then irradiates the shell, drives it out even quasi-relativistically, and then you have a collapse to a black hole, and this is how I interpret the gamma ray burst observations. And it has much better possibility to explain the standard energy reservoir, energy upper limit, where you have a constant collapse of a neutron star to a black hole, then penetrating a surrounding very strong, very massive shell. So that's one of the features, since I think it's still an unbelievable result about this standard energy, even if it's not exact in all cases. Okay. And it also folds right into why short bursts could be cognate phenomena. In one case, it's highly magnetized, rotationally supported gamma neutron stars collapsing to black holes. Here it's just accretion-induced and collapse of neutron stars to black holes, much like also McFadgen and Ramirez-Ruiz, although and Zhang have proposed though. But the thing is, if you explain the SWIFT observations for long gamma ray bursts, you also have to do it for the short, hard gamma ray bursts because of this unbelievable behavior you also see in a short, hard GRB. So they have to have some similarity. So that's the basic story. I wanted to provide what I think are new challenges from the SWIFT data, and this is how I interpret it in an external shock model, and I also interpret those X-ray flares. So I'm really not convinced yet that you have continued activity of the central engine as well as refreshed shocks. Perhaps I'm wrong. Thermal and non-thermal neutral beams making hadronic and leptonic emission components. And you've heard now how I think, I want to understand GRB physics. There's no simple solution, but I think that this holds more promise. Thanks.
Set of alternative views?
I have a couple of questions. One is the first problem addressed, you turn off very quickly. How about something where, which is completely different, you know, where it's some sort of analogous to like a stellar flare. I'm not going to give you the details because I won't even know, but it's a magnetic reconnection which has essentially zero time.
But it has to be in a very confined region, too.
Yeah.
And it has to be relativistically outflowing.
Absolutely. This is like one of the Star Wars things. Magnetic bombs are launched. And
I invite people to try to explain this. What puzzles me is that it's quasi-universal. This always takes place at a few hundred seconds. And it also reproduces the curvature relationship in most cases. Now, if you have a flare, this is essentially what we're talking about. A flare, however you want to make that flare, the kinematic models just said that you had a spherical symmetry, which is broader than the Doppler beaming cone. And then within that context, you have to try to understand how it turns off, why these characteristic pulses one gets from what I think is a colliding shell geometry don't appear. Now, a flash like you described would also seem to have a rising phase and then a decaying phase. The only way I can avoid having a rising phase is by having a single blast wave which goes out, radiates the entire time until it passes through a new medium and then turns off.
The next question I had was, let's say you see some X-ray emission for several days, and the day after the explosion, you see a factor of two variation in 1 hour. do you think that's a clump?
Well, potentially yes, because what you have is that as you go to larger and larger distances, you get a more dilute blast wave, and actually you can transfer the energy more effectively in lower mass clouds, because then you don't have to sweep up so much material. Now the issue is your cloud becomes sort of like a Swiss cheese object as it passes through these clumps, the shrapnel. You still have some high energy outflow, and then you have the low energy outflow that's previously intercepted other clumps. And could you have a high energy outflow that finally hits a clump at some 10 to the 17th to 10 to the 18th centimeters to make a flash? I think so.
I think, though, you have energetic problems with high radii, with dilute shock waves to make, you know, large amplitude flares.
Large amplitude.
Now,
I have several comments. One, it's very hard to get the sharp large amplitude spike in the light curve from encountering an external density clump.
Well, that's what people say, but I believe I've done the most detailed simulation, and there's no problem. But you have to have this case that if the blast wave goes too far out, it has to remain thin.
The main problem is that if you encounter a dense clump, then basically whenever the shock encounters it, it decelerates significantly and you lose a lot because of that.
But of course it decelerates significantly. That's how you get the transformation of the ejected kinetic energy into the internal energy of the blast.
Yes, but then you lose a lot from the reduced beaming. So it's very hard to get the sharp
blast. That's why you need a thin shell. I agree. You need a thin shell for that very reason. Because then you have a strong forward shock, which means that you don't have a small gamma factor in the solution to the relativistic hydrodynamic equations.
So.
And I accept that this should be the main criticism of my approach, that it requires the thin shell of the blast wave much smaller than what's expected from the spreading arguments that have been made. But I think there's a number of ways to avoid that. I mean, the spreading arguments are sort of isotropically averaged. Here we're just talking about the blast wave shell within a small range of opening angles. Second, you could have the outflow, which is encountering a very tenuous medium, and that strong forward shock will then cause the rest of the shell to compress, or it doesn't spread. But this is the main physics that's required for an external shock model to work.
I don't quite agree to that, and I have also a few comments about the SWIFT results. One, you want it to be very robust, and you need a whole lot of coincidences to occur, and you said 60 to 80% of the cases. I don't see how you naturally get the drop of 100 and get it just about right and just about you know, the appropriate values for the opening angle and all of that. You need a whole number of basically three parameters to right range.
As I opened the talk, I showed how you get natural selection biases to see gamma naught of 300. Everything else seems to be sort of the range of the physics that we now understand. So the gamma naught issue is a question, but just as you just pointed out, if gamma naught's too small, you just don't see anything. And if it's too large, nature probably doesn't make those. So there's not the fine tuning is to have a change in the medium environment at this 10 to the 16th, 10 to the 17th centimeters.
And to have the angle just right, so you also see the edge of this component.
Let me turn it.
If you do see that, you have an exponential decay, not a parallel.
Let me turn it around for the people who advocate the internal shell model. How is it that you get these unbelievably different gamma ray burst blast waves in their pulsed emission, and yet the central engine knows to turn off its activity just at 100 seconds, even though it's doing all sorts of different calisthenics in the early phase?
It doesn't seem to turn off exactly at 100 seconds. There's a pretty wide range in durations, and even then we see evidence for later time activities in the later flares. And by the way, if you take into account the right zero time for this curvature effect, taking into account that the single collision produces a single pulse, then you can reproduce pretty nicely is decaying.
Except for the rising phase problem.
Let me move on to... We'll move on to another question here,
Matt. Also on the temporal decays and the X-rays, Chuck, obviously the decay index depends on both the clumping structure and the angular structure of the jet. Which, can you disentangle those? Is there like one structure that will dominate for, say, T to the minus 5 decays and another for T to the minus 3? Is there any way you can perform diagnostics?
We have this beautiful diagnostic of the curvature relation.
Right.
This prediction before Swift that there's a nice relationship between the spectral index and the decay curve. Now, to get more to get violations of that, I mean, this is the problem that's unsolved.
Right, but that's probing the clump structure, okay, as opposed to the angular structure.
I've separated those two issues out. I mean, the clumping could be due to some shrapnel in the medium, but it may be unrelated to the whole other issue. I think they're quite separate effects.
Okay, we'll take one last question from Felix, and then there is a quick result from Stefan Immler on a new observation of a supernova. Stefan, are you somewhere here? Yes.
Chuck, my question is about this transport of energy through neutrons produced in photon productions. It's true that it's very effective way to transport energy, kinetic energy, to larger distances, but it's not clear how you use this energy, because the only way to get this energy is through radiation of decay electrons, because protons do not interact anymore, but decay electrons get only 0.1% of energy.
No. Once a neutron decays into a proton, you have a charged particle which is passing through a medium that it presumably is magnetized. That magnetic field causes the proton to then swing around and transfer its energy to the medium.
So you produce another shock there?
Well, this is a very interesting feature we've been talking about in jet physics. If you have a neutron beam going out and the neutron beam's momentum exponentially decays, early on it just completely overpowers the medium. Later on it doesn't even touch the medium, and then you get this accumulation which forms these, in a continuous flow for a jet, you form these little clumps of material, these filaments that you see in the Chandra observations of X-ray jetted sources. But here it's a completely different thing, because it's an impulsive event, and then you have the neutrons that go out, a one-time event, and it's not clear just how it...
Okay. Yeah. I think we can do this over coffee. Thanks very much. So this is a very brief presentation, because it's a hot new result, and so you have to tell us what it is.
Okay. Who's speaking?
I'll start.
Don't do too much here. 5 minutes, okay?
Sure. One moment. Stefan and I are, and Alicia. We're going to present our results that we took in the last 24 hours using the VLA and SWIFT. Alicia Soderberg and myself and my collaborators had about 4.5 hours of VLA observations last night, which were graciously given as a target opportunity by the scheduling committee. We report the very stringent non-detections of 2000X at the X band, which is 3.6 centimeters, and at the K band, the radio K, which is 1.3 centimeters, with the flux limits, the luminosity limits given here. The ATELs are posted, and there'll be a circular coming out shortly on our half. We had roughly 4.5 hours, 2.5 in the X band observation, and two hours in the K band observation. And we were able to place at least roughly a upper limit on the mass loss rate, a crude upper limit of a few times 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. So we'll go ahead and turn it over to Stefan. He can talk about some of the SWIFT detections.
Yeah, so we had a SWIFT observation. We had a SWIFT observation basically in November of M100. So see on the left-hand side the V, B, and U band image. And on the right-hand side is an observation just taken yesterday. And as you can see here, the supernova that had a magnitude of 15.7 in the V band. And if you go to shorter wavelength, in the middle panel now is the UV image of the galaxy. You see also supernova 1979C, which is very bright still in the ultraviolet 26 years after the outburst. And the supernova 2006X is detected in two of the three UV bands, but not in the shortest wavelength band. And on the right-hand panel is an X-ray image obtained yesterday of the galaxy. And the supernova is not detected in X-rays, down to 3 sigma upper limit of 9 times 10 to 39 Hz per second. At the top right, you see a V ultraviolet and X-ray band image of the galaxy. Just thought you might be interested in that. Thanks.